You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Of the 150 men of the Pelican Rifles of Louisiana that left their community to serve in the Civil War, 119 did not return. Of the 32 soldiers who survived, 31 were wounded, meaning that only a single man came back physically unharmed. Companies raised from a single community often resulted in the loss of an entire generation of young men. Shannon Moick is a park ranger at Cedar Creek and Belgrove National Historical Park. After attending the Art Institute of Pittsburgh and spending a decade there as a music promoter and retail manager, she moved back to the Shenandoah Valley, where she attended Lord Fairfax Community College in Middletown, Virginia. Her passion for history was reignited when she took a World Civilization History class. Ms. Moick joined the Cedar Creek and Belgrove staff as a seasonal hire during the park's inaugural season as an interpreter in 2010 and completed her dual degrees in the spring of 2013. She is now a full-time permanent ranger on the team. Currently, Ms. Moick's responsibilities include interpretation, volunteer management, website management, social media coordination, and assisting in the development of the park. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton, in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled, The Civil War Through Different Lenses, Lost Generation. Here's Shannon Moick.
This is such a fun experience for me. As Rick said, I've been working at the park since 2010, but most of my experience has been within the park and working actually in the field. So to actually come indoors, work with a PowerPoint, work with a microphone, this is all new to me. So bear with me when I forget to go, change slide, so because I know that's going to happen. I'm going to get excited. As Rick said, I'm from Cedar Creek and Belgrove National Park. It's a relatively new park, and we are what is known as a partnership park. It's kind of complicated, so I'd love to invite you all to come visit. It sounds like Rick has given you a good grasp of a lot of Virginia battlefields, so you might already know a little bit about it, the Battle of Cedar Creek. But up at that front table, I brought lots of information about what we have going on, because this October is the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Cedar Creek, and we are doing loads of programming, so we invite you to come visit us. There you go. Tonight, I am presenting a program that is very special to me. This was a paper I wrote for school, and I loved it so much. I loved the story of this lost generation, this group of young American men, both from the North and South, who are going to give their lives for the cause that they so valiantly believed in. And I turned this paper into a two-hour tour, and now I've modified it into this lecture for you, so I'm really excited. Hope you enjoy it. I first want to talk about the common experience of the Civil War soldier. Of course, we know in April of 1861, President Lincoln will call for troops, and right after, President Jefferson Davis of the Confederacy will also call for volunteers. And for many, these regiments are going to be formed by local communities. And this is an example here of the 44th Indiana Infantry of Company H. But I want to tell you about an extreme example of this lost generation. Now, companies being raised from the same communities caused these areas to lose an entire generation of men. The Pelican Rifles, an example, known as the 2nd Louisiana Volunteers, is an extreme example of this. Of the 151 men who served in the unit, 119 died in the war. Of the 32 who survived, 31 were wounded, meaning only one young man came back physically unharmed. But Lord only knows what the mental and emotional harm that was done during the years of war. Now, most of these men were not killed or casualties to battlefield wounds. Lots of issues in terms of disease, illness, sanitation, measles, pneumonia, smallpox, dysentery, diarrhea, typhoid, cholera are all going to be extreme situations that these men will have to live through. One New Hampshire soldier wrote, "It is fearful to wake at night and to hear the sounds made by the men about you. All night long, the sounds of men coughing, breathing heavy and hoarse with half-choked throats, moaning and groaning with acute pain." So sleeping was not very fun, even if you were well. Lice and fleas was a common issue. An Iowa soldier explained, "I have seen men literally wear out their underclothes without a change, and when they threw them off, they would swarm with vermin like and be like an anthill when disturbed." The lack of cleanliness. Thank goodness for the Civil War, because from that we really advanced our medical techniques. A Union medical cadet by the name of W.W. Keene, who worked during the aftermath of the Battle of Antietam, later became a leading surgeon during the 19th century, stated, "We operated in blood-stained and often pus-stained coats, the veterans of 100 fights. We used undisinfected instruments from undisinfected plush-lined cases, and still worse, used marine sponges which had been prior used and had been only washed in tap water." So again, you might have almost made it, but then when you were treated, these horrible situations could cause other complications. But as I said, through the Civil War, great advancements were made in hospitalization, sanitation, medicine, ambulance surgery, and of course, just basic hygiene through the Civil War. Now with this macro look, for years and years and years, the number had been 620,000 casualties, which is astounding. With that, deaths. With that, the casualties would have been over 1 million. But there's been a new study in the last couple years from a gentleman, J. David Hacker, who's a demographic historian from Binghamton University in New York, and he's recalculated that death toll to 750,000. 620, 750, let's estimate 1.5 million casualties. That's an extreme amount. Thinking of that number, it's kind of hard. You lose sight of the fact that each number represents a life. And from that life, there is a family and a community and friendships who are going to be affected by whatever happens to that one life. From this, we have these battlefield scenes, which are truly a wonder from that period, that we have these images. Antietam, Gettysburg, these are men that are never going to return home. The majority of these deaths, as I keep saying, this lost generation, is going to come from those Americans born between 1835 and 1845, many of them being in their 20s fighting during this war. So these numbers, again, are staggering, and I want to turn our focus from this macro of numbers and bring it down to two lives, both who will be mortally wounded at the Battle of Cedar Creek. The first gentleman I'd like to introduce you to is Major General Stephen Dodson Ramser, known as Dodd to his friends and family. Now, he was born on May 31st, 1837 in Lincolnton, North Carolina, about 40 miles northwest of Charlotte, North Carolina. He was the second of 9 children. He grew up as a normal North Carolinian country boy. He swam and he fished and he hunted and he loved being on his horses. Growing up, he went to the Pleasant Retreat Academy in Lincolnton, where at age 15, he became the president of their debate society. He was an avid reader, and he especially loved reading about Revolutionary War history books, because two of his grandfathers had fought in the Rev War, and he was very much inspired by it. He was a devout Christian and believed in his civic duty. He was very disappointed because his dream was to get into West Point, and initially he was not accepted. And while he didn't go there, he ended up at Davidson College, which is about 25 miles east of Lincolnton, where he found his mentor, Daniel H. Hill. Now, Dodd would later serve under Hill during the Civil War, so again, these communities working together. And Hill is ultimately the one who will secure appointment for Dodd at West Point, so furthering, cementing this relationship. Now, West Point, of course, is going to be such a crucial epicenter because so many friends from school will later go on to fight each other during the war. And Ramser's case is certainly a true example of this, as we learn later on in this talk. Now, this institution established this brotherhood, and some of his closest friends he would fight. These would be Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer, Captain Henry A. DuPont, General Wesley Merritt, and Colonel Alexander C.M. Pennington. Now, he will fight for the Confederacy, and those men all fought for the Union. Now, during his class, he will also serve be a student alongside Major General Thomas Rosser, who he will fight for the Confederacy for at Cedar Creek. Now, as the nation's falling apart, Dodd realizes that he needs to step down from the U.S. Army, and he joins the Confederacy, and he will quickly rise through these ranks. He will fight at some amazing battles, and he will be wounded. He will fight at the Seven Days Battle, serving under Major General Henry Harvey Hill from his mentor at college. He will be seriously wounded at Malvern Hill with a bullet to the arm. He will then command at Chancellorsville, where he will be wounded in the shin. He will fight at Gettysburg. He will fight at the Wilderness. He will fight at Spotsylvania. Again, while fighting at the Bloody Angle, he will be wounded again. On June 1st, 1864, he will rise to the rank of Major General, the youngest at 27 years old. So a major accomplishment. And then by that fall campaign, he will be fighting through the Shenandoah Valley, the raid on Washington, D.C. with Early, and then, of course, the 64 campaign. Now, that's all school and war and growing up, but let's turn to kind of the lovely side of life. And this is Ellen Elizabeth Richmond. This is his cousin, who, while he's convalescing from these wounds, will keep heading to her home in Milton, where they will fall in love. Now, the first time they really spend quality time together is in 1862. And when he returns back to the front, they will exchange amazing amount of letters. And I've gotten to read many of them, and I think these boys really knew how to express eloquently their feelings. And I will be sharing some of these with you. Actually, a letter he wrote on September 17, 1863 states, "I am heartsick. My disappointment has almost unmanned me. But no, I will perform my duty here and there. I'll come and claim your love. You can imagine, my heart's darling, what a trial this is for me." And it goes on and on and on. And ultimately, they will marry on October 28, 1863, and they will have a one-month honeymoon together. And then Nellie will join him from January of 64 to April of 64, where they will conceive their first child. And that is such an important part of the story. But we'll learn more about that in just a moment. We'll change the slide. Another example of this generation lost is Colonel Charles Russell Lowell, Jr., known as Charlie. Charlie is from New England. He was born on January 2nd, 1835, to Charles Russell Sr. and Anna Cabot Jackson. Both the Lowell and Jackson families had been major forces in New England. Charlie's uncle was the Transcendentalist writer James Russell Lowell. Abolitionist family, devout in their beliefs. Unfortunately for this section of the Lowell family, Charles Russell Sr. was not a great manager and kind of threw them into an economic turmoil where Anna, the mother, opened a school in their home. So education was incredibly important to the Lowell family, and Charles will ultimately make his way to Harvard, where he becomes valedictorian. I should also mention he was also mentored by that other famous guy, Ralph Waldo Emerson. So, give you a little background on Charlie. So, Charlie and Dodd, very different but very similar. Just keep keep seeing their nobility and their belief and their sacrifice for things that are important to them. Now, after he graduated from Harvard, he became a merchant in Boston. And that kind of bored him, so he looked for something else, and he wanted to learn about iron manufacturing, where he became a common workman in the Ames Company, and he essentially launched himself on a promising career at the forefront of iron manufacturing. From there, he went to the Trenton Iron Works to take up a position in charge of puddling. Now, from this hard labor, he ultimately damaged his lungs, and he was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Now, their family doctor said, you need to take 10 years off and go to Europe. Wow. Now, I don't want to get sick to be able to do that. But Charlie was so passionate about bringing back the family name, he refused to go. And he got a job with another important company, the J.M. Forbes Company. But he wasn't doing so well. So Mr. Forbes kind of took a shine to this kid and said, I want you to be my kid's mentor as we go to the Caribbean. And on this trip is when Charlie first had his first-hand experience with slavery. And he wasn't impressed. And through this, the friendship between Charlie and Forbes grew tight. And Forbes ultimately said, you're not getting any better, you need to go. So Charlie went abroad to convalesce for 2 years. And overall, he was doing better. But he was still very much engaged with American politics, and boy, he was paying attention to Bleeding Kansas, the attack on Charles Sumner from Massachusetts by Congressman Preston Brooks, and he was also paying attention to the Dred Scott case. So after 2 years, he felt his health was better, so he came back, and he went to work for Forbes as an assistant treasurer and land agent for the Burlington and Missouri River Railroad Company in southeastern Iowa. But in 1860, Charlie knew he wanted to get back east, and he took a position as iron master at the Mount Savage Iron Works near Cumberland, Maryland. Now, by May of 61, he joined the U.S. Army, where he was commissioned captain of the 3rd U.S. Cavalry and was on McClellan's staff until 1862. He will see action in the Peninsular Campaign. He will fight at Antietam. But by the time he gets to Cedar Creek, he will be leading the Reserve 1st Division of the Cavalry Corps. Okay, let's go to his fun stuff. Now, he didn't marry Robert Goldshaw. Does everybody know who this gentleman is? Robert Goldshaw, leader of the 54th Massachusetts, the All Black Regiment. Of course, we most know him from The Moving Glory. Now, Robert and Charlie were good friends. And it was through Robert's friendship that he met her sister, Josephine Shaw. And in a romance that very much parallels Dodd and Nellie's, Effie and Charlie will have this whirlwind courtship. And they will be married on October 31st, just 3 days after Nellie and Dodd do. So again, this wartime excitement, the brides, the love, all counteracting this horror of what we've already discussed about what it is to be on the battlefield. Now, jumping forward, the Fall 64 campaign. Oh, I'm sorry, this is Charlie and Effie together. Love. And he wrote, not nearly as eloquently as our friend Dodd, but oh, the love letters are just amazing. Now, if we move forward, we'll talk a little bit more about Dodd as we're talking about the 1864 campaign. I mean, he's felt war. He's been wounded numerous times. But something very exciting comes to his attention. If you guys know the Shenandoah Valley, we've got the Allegheny Mountains to the west. We've got the Blue Ridge to the east. Of course, you guys are right near in the Blue Ridge. Are we in the Blue Ridge or we're on the other side? We're out of my element, sorry. But splitting the Shenandoah Valley by about 50 miles is the Massanutten Mountain Range. And at the northern end, there was a signaling station that the Confederacy used. And from a signal that had come, Dodd had learned that his first child had been born and that it was a successful birth. The child and his wife had survived. But he did not know whether the child was a son or a daughter. Now, through the fall campaign, the Confederates had not fared well. But he was convinced, he knew an upcoming battle was ahead of him. And on that morning of the Battle of Cedar Creek, he will wear a flower in his lapel, convinced of a Confederate victory and a furlough to go home to his new bride and his new child. And on October 17th, he writes to Nellie about learning about the birth. "My darling wife, I received late last night the flowing dispatch through the Signal Corps. The crisis is over and all is well. Though this leaves much to conjecture, yet it has relieved me of the greatest anxiety of my life. Oh, how I long to be with you. I don't know how I can bear to be separated for much longer. I feel like I must see you and be with you and our little darling." So imagine going from learning this 2 days later to go into battle convinced that you were going to meet the little loves of your life. Let's talk a little bit about Lowell in the days leading up to the Battle of Cedar Creek. Now, Lowell writes a letter to his wife, Effie, on October 15, 1864. "In order to get in light marching order and to be in readiness to move, I conjecture a raid is on our foot for our division, perhaps to Charlottesville. If so, you will not hear from me for a week or even for 10 days. I think Sheridan will have one more battle here, probably while we are gone. I am sorry to miss it, but perhaps we shall be of more use where we are going. You will know that I am safe at any rate." Now, for a wife to be receiving this, and then a few days later, Charlie will be in a battle that he was sorry he might miss, and unfortunately will not survive. So these two men will ultimately meet their fate here at Cedar Creek. And what I'd like to do, unfortunately, my scanner at work decided not to cooperate with me. So I'm just going to pass out some sketches, and while I'm talking, please feel free. And these are the last scenes of these two men at Cedar Creek, done by a sketch artist by the name of James Taylor. So as I'm telling the story, hopefully these images will help make an impact. Now, this surprise attack by the Confederates, as I've mentioned, they hadn't done so well in the fall campaign. And General Jubal Early, who led the Confederate force, was trying to help General Robert E. Lee by keeping the Federals occupied in the Shenandoah Valley. So he will lead this incredible surprise attack. And Ramseur, Dodd's division, is going to be so crucial. The Confederates will have great success through the morning, seeming Confederate victory by noon. Now, Major General Phil Sheridan, who leads the Federal forces, had been in Washington, D.C. for a meeting, the idea being that the Federals had successful victory in the valley, so therefore can make it down to Richmond to help General Grant. And with that, he hadn't made it back to the battlefield on time for this surprise attack. But he will make a gallop from Winchester, Virginia, about 12 miles north of Middletown, back, which is epically known as Sheridan's Ride. And he will face, by this point, a retreating army that has been incredibly demoralized by this Confederate attack. But Sheridan is able to rally the troops, develop a counterattack, and proceed forward. And through the counterattack, Ramseur will fight valiantly, Charlie's cavalry corps will fight valiantly, and they're both going to be crucial for their sides. Now, there is a structure on the battlefield. It was the Miller House. And Dodd will fight, and he will attempt to rally his troops, because as these Federals, who were running far, far north that morning, are now surprising the Confederates by having the vigor to come back and fight for the battlefield. And Ramseur will have his horse struck, secure another one, and as he is mounting it, a bullet will strike him through his right side, passing through his lungs and below his left arm. Now, from his adjutant general, Robert R. Hutchinson, in a letter dated on October 20th, 1864, to Dodd's wife, Nellie, in regards to these moments. He received his mortal wound yesterday afternoon between 5 and 6 p.m. at the post of honor and of danger where he always was. Our troops had fallen back a short distance, but he reformed and were stubbornly contesting a position on a hill which the enemy from all three sides attacked. He exposed himself to every shot, cheering and encouraging all. I was not far from him when I saw his horse shot. He procured another, which was also shot immediately after he received his fatal wound, all in the space of a few minutes. I ran over to him, got him off on an ambulance, ran over to him, got some men, and bore him the rear. Your brother joined us on the way. I then went off after an ambulance, found it, but on returning saw that he had been left, as I thought, in the enemy's lines. Now, ultimately, they will secure an ambulance. He will almost escape, and when they're very near escape, they will be captured by the Federals. And when the Federals realize it's Major General Stephen Dodson Ramsey, they bring him back to the Federal headquarters at Belgrove Plantation. Now, from this point, he is mortally wounded, and they will do everything in their capacity to care for Dodd. But let's go ahead and go back to Charlie. I think we might have missed. Sorry. Now, Charlie, through the years of war, had had 13 horses shot from under him, but he never sustained any injury. As I mentioned, he will really see major action through the afternoon, but in the morning, he will be conferring with another Union soldier on horseback in the town of Middletown, where a sharpshooter from one of the buildings in town, because most of the battlefield happened in the rural lands, but he will get struck in the lung, and it will embed in his chest, but it won't go through. And he knew at that moment that it was not going to be a quick death. But he refused to go to the back of the lines, no matter how much his men encouraged him to do so. And he felt that it would be of his post of honor to die as his brother-in-law had done so before him. He also immediately asked for whiskey. Gallant soldier, right? I think that helps anybody get through a shock like that. And of course, having suffered from the tuberculosis, his lungs weren't in great shape anyway. Now, as I mentioned, Sheridan, when he returns, develops this plan of counterattack. Charlie was not, as his whole life, going to put a pause and think of himself first, and he wants to lead the counterattack charge. Now, at 3 p.m., the counterattack was supposed to happen, but intelligence had come in, causing Sheridan to give pause. But those orders hadn't made it to the field, so they had to lift Charlie onto the horse and strap him down because he was so weak. And with that, he waits for about an hour. And when finally at 4:15, the charge is finally given, or the order is finally given for the charge, he will commence. But he is so weak at this point, he cannot speak above a whisper. And his other men will have to call out the orders to his division. So pretty heroic. Now, as this counterattack is occurring, he will get struck again, and this will be the mortal wounding. He has no choice, but he does go back to the hospital. And once the Federals have recaptured the town, he's then taken to a house to lay out. Now for Charlie, he will make it through the night, and in the morning, his men will come to see him. And he said to one of the officers, "My only regret is that I cannot do something more for our cause." And my poor wife, I'm afraid this will kill her. He will die at 9 a.m. on October 20th, 1864. Now for Charlie, he will gain the commission of Brigadier General, U.S. Volunteers to date from the Battle of October 19th. To Lowell, General Sheridan paid this tribute. I do not think there is a quality I could have added to Lowell. He was the perfection of a man and a soldier. Now, to show an example of this generation lost, of the 14 cousins of Charlie who had gone to fight, now the seventh was dead. I can't imagine those losses in my own family. And this was just part of reality for those serving in the Civil War. Now, Lowell will die 2 weeks short of his first wedding anniversary, 1 month before his first and only daughter, Carlotta, and less than 3 months before his 30th birthday. Newspaper headlines read, "Lament for a true knight and noble death." Harper's Weekly wrote about Lowell's death on November 5th, 1864. "And so long as the grass grows green upon the graves of these dear and heroic youths, the hearts that loved and honored them are pledged more surely than ever to the overthrow of the system which instigated this rebellion to destroy the country and murders our friends and brothers who die to save it." Now, if we look at Ramsar, this monument stands today. It was erected in 1920. And from here, we have Senator Henry DuPont, who was his enemy on that day of battle, but his friend from West Point, and the daughter he never knew, Mary. Now, Senator DuPont spoke at this commemoration, and it's very moving, and I just want to read a brief bit. Once he learned about the wounding and that Dodd was mortally wounded and laying in one of the bedrooms, he said he put his own necessities to the side to go to his friend. The room was absolutely still. At the other end were the four Confederates, the surgeon examining bottles on the windowsill. Approaching the bed, I said, "Ramsar, do you know me?" I mentioned my name. He opened his eyes, in which I saw recognition and apparently a gleam of pleasure. So great was my physical exhaustion that I seated myself as quietly as possible on the side rail of the bedstead. But almost the imperceptible jar thus occasioned gave the sufferer a thrill of pain to my extreme distress. Speaking with the greatest effort, he said to me, "DuPont, you know how I suffer," and then relapsed into silence and closed his eyes, not, however, before extending his hand and firmly grasping and holding mine. Hours before, they were fighting against each other on the battlefield. I think that's remarkable for what these soldiers shared together. Now, these two men with whose promise and grace were exemplified on the battlefield. Ramsar, potential lost. He was a man who lived as he thought right and died as a consequence. His beliefs epitomized many of those held by Southern gentlemen of his day. Like so many of his class in Southern society, the most prominent, Robert E. Lee, Ramsar was culturally, morally, and spiritually compelled by honor to defend his family, his community, and just as important, his new nation. Now for Lowell, Mr. Forbes believed he would one day be president. Imagine the potential loss there. Two examples of the many children who would never know their fathers, of wives who would mourn their husbands the rest of their lives for the men they loved, for communities who nearly lost all of the young men who would be their next leaders, farmers, or businessmen. Now, after Charlie's loss, Effie struggled with severe depression. But when she came out of her depression, she became actively involved and engaged with helping the poor and disadvantaged in New York City. She founded the New York City Charity Organization and became an inspiration for social reformers and several generations later, feminists. It's interesting to think if Lowell had survived, her potential that might not have been shown. Life is so bizarre. But I think President Abraham Lincoln summed this all up very eloquently. And it's kind of astounding that he would have to write this letter on May 25th, 1861 to a family, not knowing that the war would last for so much longer. And he stated, "In the untimely loss of your noble son, our affliction here is scarcely less than your own. So much of promised usefulness to one's country and of bright hopes for oneself and friends have rarely been so suddenly dashed as in his fall." And with that, folks, the Lost Generation.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.